Hello, and thank you for joining today's Family Office In Focus podcast. My name is Mark Tepsik, and I'm the Family Office Design and Governance Strategist for Family Office Solutions. Family Office Solutions is a team of dedicated specialists who work with our private wealth advisors to deliver holistic advice to the firm's wealthiest families. For today's podcast and conversation, I'm joined by Patrick McCurry, partner at McDermott Will & Emery out of Chicago. This conversation will center around long-term compensation strategies for family office executives and employees. So before we begin, I want to mention that McDermott Will & Emery and Patrick McCurry is not affiliated with UBS, and this is not a recommendation of or a business referral to them. So, Patrick, would love for you to give us some background about yourself and your practice at McDermott.
Sure. First of all, thanks, Mark and UBS for hosting me on this podcast. I really appreciate the opportunity to spend some time with you. So my practice is a little bit of a niche practice, I would say. I started McDermott as a summer associate as a partnership tax expert. And I'd say my practice over the last 7 or 8 years has really morphed into helping single family offices structure the compensation both to the family offices themselves and then to their employees and investment teams. So we do a lot of, really 99% of my time every day is spent on single family office structuring matters. So I'd say a little bit of a niche.
I would say so. Okay, so with respect to the long-term compensation, can you give us an overview of some of the conversations you're having with these family offices surrounding this compensation strategy?
Sure. Yeah, it's a very, very hot ticket topic. What's interesting about it is sometimes it's like way overdue to have the conversation because a lot of the really great people at single family offices don't want to be considered self-promoters. So I've got clients where this has been kicking around for a decade. And, you know, the CEO or CIO of the family office just doesn't want to bring up the topic because they don't want to be seen as sort of self-interested, et cetera. So it's a very interesting dynamic, to say the least. I mean, right now, I've got probably 40 live projects that are all some type of phantom co-investor carry structure. So super, super active. It's really, really important because the core, I think, of most single family offices from an executive team perspective is just alignment, stickiness, trust building, you know, obviously like incentivizing the right behaviors, both investment and non-investment behaviors. And it's a huge area of focus for us, and it's obviously one of the most important things to get right culturally, economically, et cetera, within a single family office. So, but sometimes it's a tough conversation actually to have because you don't necessarily know even where to start. So it's interesting. You gotta back all the way up, I think, and get to first principles.
Okay. Yeah, no, I love that kind of that insight. You know, when you said that family office executives don't want to necessarily be seen as self-promoting because really they're there to represent the family. It's much easier on the outset if you're just joining, right? You already kind of have this, you know, you're being brought on and it's a slightly more, I would say, known environment at this point than it was maybe 5-10 years ago. But you're exactly right. I mean, these incentives can really help drive the alignment. So, you know, appreciate that. So let's dive into a couple of the more common types of plans, which you already referenced, which is carried interest, co-investment, and what is called synthetic or phantom equity. Can you just give a brief overview of each of these?
Sure. Yeah. So a carried interest is another phrase for what's called a profits interest under the income tax law, which is basically an equity grant that makes you a partner for income tax purposes that has a liquidation value of zero. So it's really anything. If you sold all the investments that you're getting carry on the date of grant, you would get nothing, but you can get all the upside as agreed between the family and the individual. So sometimes it's like a 5% carry or a 10%. Sometimes there's a hurdle. Sometimes it's deal by deal. So we can get into all those details, but it's basically an equity interest that doesn't require any out-of-pocket investment by the employee. And there, it, subject to a technical discussion, which we may talk about. Generally, that's a path to long-term capital gain for the employees, which is why it's common. The next one is co-invest. Well, I'll say this, on the carry structure, it's definitely the most common of the three, I would say. And part of it, that's what a lot of, what's that?
No, that's good to know.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of it is that, you know, a lot of key employees are coming out of, or some of them certainly coming out of private equity, hedge funds, venture capital funds, where carry was the main way in which they got compensated. So the market sort of knows and understands it. One of the challenges to carry, or one of the things that I hear from my principals, is that the carry doesn't necessarily have full alignment because there's no downside alignment, meaning in the upside, it's great, but there's no skin in the game. There's no necessarily incentive to be, you know, to risk adjust your return. It's all kind of outsized upside economics, which leads me to the second thing, which is I have clients that just absolutely love co-invest structures or leverage co-invest. And the reason that some principals think there's greater alignment there is because if someone's going to put in some of their own money, so maybe I put in 100 grand and then maybe the family loans me another 200 grand and I put $300,000 into a deal, now I've got both upside and downside alignment, right? And it's not just on the upside. And I think some principals think that you need a little skin in the game to create the total alignment. So that is why I think some people like the co-invest structure. You know, sometimes it's deal by deal, sometimes it's into some type of fund vehicle, but co-invest, I think, is very intellectually easy to understand also. It's like, well, they're just getting into these deals that otherwise they probably wouldn't have access to because they don't have the flow or they wouldn't meet the minimum investment amount or whatever. So co-invest can be very popular, and then the leverage just sort of outjuices the performance, right? And usually when I see leverage co-invest, meaning the employee's borrowing in part, there's usually an out-of-pocket amount of X dollars, and then the family will loan 1, 2, 3, 4, 5X of the out-of-pocket investment to get to the loan. Some families don't like the loan program, and they just say, hey, if you want to invest your own money, by all means. So that's kind of easy to understand. One clear upside to a co-invest is that there's no doubt about it that you get long-term capital gain treatment. It also usually is investing through an entity. So, you know, you can deduct the state taxes associated, especially with, you know, California, New York resident or high tax state. So that's another structure that is tax efficient as opposed to some type of compensation where it's obviously all ordinary income, which is the last piece of this. What I think you referred to as a phantom plan, which is basically another word for just a bonus, but that's formulaic and driven by the investment returns of a portfolio. So you can just say, hey, Mark, we got this big fund-to-fund vehicle, and we don't want the complexity of having you have K-1s and state tax filings and everything else. So we're just going to give you an award that allows you to sort of synthetically invest that amount into this portfolio, but then you'll get it paid out like a bonus in a future year, and that would be all ordinary income, which is part of why these bonus plans are less popular than carry or co-invest. It's because it's not as tax efficient for the employees.
Okay, makes a lot of sense. I love the alignment of the co-invest, the leveraged co-invest, and I happen to think personally it's a little bit more flexible than a carry, but that's just my personal opinion. Okay, for the next, question, you know, you kind of already said which was the most prevalent, which is the carry rather than the leveraged co-invest or the phantom or synthetic equity. But what sort of context are you seeing each of these in, you know, real estate, direct, early stage? What does that kind of look like?
Yeah, and obviously it is highly dependent on the investment platform of the family office, the role and function of the individual. I mean, I think carry and co-invest are best suited for, I shouldn't really say this, but obviously it's very, very common when a family does real direct investing, right? Whether that's minority or majority controlled, if the employees are leading the deal sourcing and execution, and you're buying either, you know, large minority stakes or control of companies, you almost always see carry in that case. But we also see carry in like traditional private equity fund-to-fund structures. We see carry as sort of a replacement for just general discretionary bonuses and large pools of marketable securities. Sometimes there's promote in real estate deals. So it's really all over the place. I mean, I always say, just as a general theme, there is no market, meaning you just have to look at what the family's goals and objectives are in terms of the cultural piece, in terms of the economic alignment, and look at the portfolio and look at what everyone's doing in terms of value add, and just say, hey, what's the most tax efficient way to pay these people that creates the most economic alignment in a way that's administratively executable? Meaning, sometimes these things seem really good on paper, but when you get down to it, it's that the tax compliance or the legal structuring or something can be really onerous. And I always say, we've got to weigh all of these things against execution simplicity, because as you probably know, when working in families, like, elegance and simplicity is a huge premium. So
yep.
We're only taking in structural complexity and compliance if there's a material benefit either to the family, the employees, or both. And so a lot of questions that I have is like, what dollar amounts are we talking about? Because like, I talked to a client, it was a very long conversation. We were throwing all these different structures around, but when we got down to it, the dollar amount was just not going to be that material. And so I think we ended up there scrapping all of it and just going to like a discretionary sort of fuzzy performance-based bonus structure. And that was it. But if you're talking about large institutional style family offices with hundreds of millions or billions of investable assets, I mean, it's probably going to be worth doing something a little more formal than just a bonus plan, right? Because the employees want to know what they're getting, and a discretionary bonus is not going to cut it. But I think it's important what the size and scope of these platforms are going to be, because you can only then weigh the complexity and the cost of doing some of the stuff.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. And I love your comment earlier about, you know, there's really no market for it. And that's where I see a lot of questions arise, because a lot of these family offices, they're operating, you know, sort of in the dark. It's an opaque environment, meaning, you know, to your point, there's no necessarily standard of sizing across asset classes for, you know, because you're dealing with different sizes for family offices. So family offices are constantly, like, to your point earlier, even about being the family office executive or employee, going back to your principal or the principal granting these, they really just want to know what makes a lot of sense. And certainly there's surveys out there on comp, but those generally don't get into the granularity of the size of these and how they're structured. It's usually the numbers that are at stake. So, all right, let's move on a little bit. So, you know, I just mentioned this, we get a lot of questions on the size of the carry specifically. And can you talk about how you help clients through the sizing, as well as the asset classes and the hurdles? You know, what are some of the more common size of carry you're seeing, and in what context?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just tell you my spiel on this, because I get that question a lot, right? Is 10%, if people want to go right to percentages, and I say, well, look, 2% might be the right number on a $4 billion pool, and 20% may be the right number on an 80% early stage growth fund. So the percentages, I think, could be a little bit of a red herring. And just because it's really very dependent on the expected investment returns and the total just gross asset size, and frankly, the size of the team and other things. So I say, look, ultimately, this comes down to after-tax dollars and cents. That's really the goal of this. And so instead of thinking about percentages, which is a very common thing to do because family office principal calls his or her friend who's another bigger family office and say, oh, what do you do? Oh, we do 20%. Okay, done. And then I get that call like, oh, well, Jimmy does this. I'm like, I don't care, because I see 150 of these things. So like, we got to put aside these little anecdotal pieces, right, and back up and say, what is the goal here? And what are the percentages or hurdles or vesting or forfeitures or anything that makes sense for your family, for this person or this team? And I think the most helpful way to think about it is you look at the investment partnerships or pools of investable assets, and you think about how to organize that organically, really irrespective of the family office team, maybe, and just more from like a trust and estates perspective, et cetera. But let's say you've got this pool with private equity vintages, you've got a direct investment pool, and then you have a big basket of marketable securities. I think what I tell clients and teams to do is basically run the numbers on that based on a targeted annualized amount determined over a 10 or 15 year period. So Mark, like maybe your number that everybody's trying to target, assuming that there's the investment returns that everyone's expecting in a base case scenario, is X dollars or X million dollars a year. You can then derive the percentage based on the targeted gross dollar amount rather than the other way around. Because I've seen situations where nobody thought too much about the gross dollar amounts. They thought, oh, well, Blackstone gets paid 20% carry, the employee got 20%, deal by deal, no offsets, no pools. And the next thing you know, the employees are getting, you know, $30, $40 million or whatever, something that just like no one had ever thought about. And they were so fixed by both the market approach on the percentage that they just got off on the gross amount. And ultimately, this is just about dollars and cents. But if you run scenarios on different pools, say, okay, well, we expect a 12% IRR on private equity. Let's run the math on that to get the baseline targeted annual comp, and we can run through the timing of that. But if it was 16% and this person got X, would we be cool with that? Or if it was only a 6% return and they got nothing because there was a hurdle or whatever, is everybody okay with that? And it's really those scenario building that all sides can look at that based on the expected articulated return assumptions and see the band of potential economic outcomes for the team and say, yeah, if we make 20% IRR, like, absolutely, we're cool with that. But if you don't run the math and the scenario building around it and you're focused too much on the percentages, I've seen people wake up unhappy on all sides of that. So I think it's important to sort of like, does that make sense, by the way?
Yeah, no, it because I always get that question on the size, and I say, listen, I can't comment on the size because you've got, to your point earlier, you may have a $100 million portfolio, you may have a $1 billion portfolio, and obviously you could talk about the different strategies and asset classes within there. But I say go and model it out because it's going to help, you know, with expectations and outcomes. And so you don't want either party, right, the family or the executive being unhappy with the outcomes. But if you have an understanding of potential outcomes, then at least everybody is on the same page going into it, right, and what that could look like down the road. So,
And that's so the game is really, it's really expectation management on all sides. Because once everybody, you know, and I've seen people model like two scenarios, one where we get 10%, the other we get 12%. That's maybe not enough because you could have really outside upside performance. And I think it's important that people see what the employees are making at a 12, 15, 30, 40, you know, like cause some of these direct investments, as you know, can be unicorns and really incredible returns. I think it is important to, not within reason, but like to really model some big upside scenarios and just so that everyone can look at the page and say, yeah, we're okay with that. And I always show it like, here's what the family made, $600 million. Here's what the employee made, $6 million. Are you cool with that? You know, like, so showing, look, this is what, if we can really achieve this outcome for the family, then this is what we're willing to part with for the employees, just so that everyone is on the same page. And because it's when there's surprises or game playing or things like that, where this culturally, set aside the care, but like culturally, that is not good. With a family office, it's got to be based on trust and really working in partnership. And part of the way you build trust is transparency, and where everyone just is on the totally on the same page and eyes wide open. So I think that robust scenario building is really important for that.
Yeah, and to your point earlier about, you know, the downside, hey, if we only make, you know, 6%, the employee gets nothing. Is the family happy with that? And is the employee happy with that? Because I've seen in some scenarios where the family office, you know, investor, employee, or executive is like, I'm out of here because I have no hope of, you know, my carry paying off. So why would I stick around? I might as well just go try again somewhere else. So, you know, modeling out best and worst case, both for the family as well as the employee, I think leads to better outcomes. So,
yeah, and I like, let's pause about that, like a hurdle, you know, because the standard is, oh, it's an 8% soft hurdle with a catch up, and it's like Blackstone. It's like, well, hold on.
Yeah.
Like, because sometimes a hurdle, having a hurdle, especially for non-investment people, where this, they're not necessarily underwriting the deals. It's just about creating alignment and having kind of sharing the wealth, creating stickiness, keeping good people. It's maybe not always appropriate to have like a preferred return hurdle, right? Or maybe you want a hurdle on the direct investment platform, but you don't need it on the liquid marketable securities pool, because that's just really a way to get sort of share the wealth rather than reward or punish underwriting. Because again, this is, I think, a trend, I assume you're seeing it as well. It's not just the CIOs or the investment people that are necessarily in these planning, you know, in these platforms. It's non-investment executives as well. It's the CFO, it's the general counsel, it's the president. And so those folks are not necessarily or maybe never underwriting. So the alignment on the hurdle and things like that, that can be very punitive in the middling case, might not be appropriate. So I think it's just about like having an open and honest conversation, understanding if you do X, then what's the incentive? And if you do Y, and like, I mean, a lot of times some of the structures we work on don't have any preferred return, because, or at least not on all the asset strategies. So I think it's got to be real bespoke. Like, there's just no one size fits all. And I think you just have open and honest communications and, you know, really understand the platform and where it's going, not just where it is. Like, where the puck is going is always a question that I ask clients, because you could look at a balance sheet in a static way, but if you know that, oh yeah, actually this is all earmarked for this sports deal, so this is, you know, you really have to understand where the portfolio is and where it's going. And then in light of that, and in light of the goals and the cultural and the alignment and everything, I kind of put it all in my brain and try to give practical advice. But yeah, I don't either say, oh, it should be X, Y, or Z. We don't really give percentages, if that makes sense.
Yep.
'Cause that's a pure business. But once they have a business objective in mind or a target, what I think is very important is like the exact legal structure, the buy sell provisions on the termination, having phantom put rights, the 10-year, like all that stuff is really important. And none of that stuff is going to be in the, you know, pick your poison on the published compensation guides. It just does not get into those details, I don't think. But that's really the art of it. It's not just the number. It's like all the other pieces of the structure that are very important.
Perfect. Sure. Can you talk briefly about the entire portfolio versus certain investments within the context of the carry?
Yeah, that's obviously a great question, but a kind of a tough one to answer in the abstract. I mean, a core question that you have, let's say a direct investment portfolio. Do you do deal by deal carry? Do you do some type of European waterfall with vintage periods? Do you do an evergreen? There's like lots of ways to skin that cat. And to me, the question of like, what assets does this apply to or not is just like a very fact specific question that, you know, it's kind of hard to answer just in the abstract, but those are really, really important questions to ask, is defining the assets to which, whether it's carry, co-invest, or phantom, like what does this relate to? Generally, it's going to be the family's direct investment portfolio, maybe their private equity fund or venture capital funds, potentially, but not always, their marketable securities, although sometimes that's just outsourced to a third party and the team really doesn't actively trade or do something. So sometimes you see certain asset classes just left out completely. I mean, mostly you're dealing with the asset classes that the team is overseeing and more actively manage, but that's not always the case either. So it really just totally depends on the atmosphere of the family office and the portfolio.
You know, on the vesting of the carry, can you talk a little bit about that, what that could look like?
Yeah, I would say almost always, although not always, you have some type of vesting, meaning if the person sticks around, they get more and more, piece of the carry in the money, so to speak. And usually it's like a 3 or 4 year vesting period. So for example, let's say, Mark, you join the family office and we say, okay, well, you're not going to be vested day one, meaning if you left within the first 12 months, you get nothing. But 25% of that carry vests in the first anniversary of the grant, and then let's say the remaining 75% vests quarterly over the last 3 years of the four-year period. That would be a very common. And even with vestings, it can mean different things. Sometimes it means you only get economics if you're vested. And sometimes it means so long as you're there, you get all the economics, but the vesting relates to the portion of the carry that you would get paid out on if you leave. So normally, if you are unvested in something and you leave for any reason, you forfeit the unvested portion. And then oftentimes the vested piece of the carry is subject to a right of the family to buy you out at some type of fair market value formula. So it matters in the departure situation, which is the whole point of vesting, is to try to create long-term incentives for people to stick with you to maximize their payout.
Perfect.
As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreement and disclosures that we provide to you about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary or ask your UBS financial advisor for a copy.